Welcome to Covenant's first ever podcasted class. I'm Larissa Bossmeyer, the Director of Ministries here at Covenant. This is the first class in our series, Faithfulness in a World Forgotten, Learning from the Church in the Middle Ages. Before we jump into today's content, I want to give a little background on why we're having this class and where it'll go over the next several weeks. As some of you may remember, our last class was on the Church Fathers and ended with a discussion on Augustine. If we were working our way through church history, the next logical stop would be the Church of the Middle Ages, using Augustine as a bridge between the two historical eras, as he is a man that lives in the waning years of the Roman Empire, as the glamour and success of Rome begins to crumble amid foreign invasions, disease, and political instability. We're making that logical jump today, and we'll spend some time discussing Augustine. This class was partly conceived out of that continuity. Evangelical Protestants often like to look back at the early church in the first few centuries after Christ, and then skip right to the Reformation or later. There's often a sense in Protestantism that the era of the Catholic Church was an erroneous segue away from true faith, which was only rediscovered by whichever Protestant thinker we attach ourselves to, whether that's Luther or Calvin or Jonathan Edwards or another person in our relatively recent history of Protestantism. When I taught philosophy at Moody Bible Institute, my students loved when we talked about Augustine. They had a lot of respect for him. They were pretty fond of Kierkegaard, too. But they had little interest in Anselm or Aquinas. They didn't understand their relevance to the faith they professed and felt bogged down in the minutiae of the questions they ask and sought the answers to. This class aims to lean into that discomfort. It's easy to treat the Middle Ages as the historical equivalent of a movie montage scene. Flash a few kings and castles on the screen, interspersed with serfs, the Crusades, maybe a Romanesque or Gothic cathedral if you're into that kind of thing. But in this class, we're slowing down a bit and taking a look at the religious leaders, scholars, and theologians of this era that stand in the gap of the Church Fathers and the Reformation. My hope is that these next few weeks will help us grow in respect for our brothers and sisters in faith that preceded us and the way their faithfulness has equipped us to be a church today. I also hope that we better understand the issues they encountered and the movements they created as a way of living in a tumultuous period in Western history. Over the next several weeks, I and other teachers from our congregation will explore different thinkers and topics. We'll look at Wycliffe and his work at making scripture accessible. We'll talk about Anselm and the scholastic movement. We'll look at the formalization and changes to the papacy and the role of women in this pre-modern society. I hope you'll join us as we learn together about the Middle Ages, and that many of you will choose to join us for our discussions on Wednesday evenings at 7:30 p.m. But before we look at those thinkers and movements, I want us to start with some historical context. I want us to understand the theological and religious movements of the Middle Ages. And so first, we have to understand the world in which they lived. On the surface, there is little that our modern era has in common with the early Middle Ages. They lived in a world with constant fear of foreign invasion, one in which the typical person was illiterate and rarely, if ever, traveled outside the town in which they lived. There was no equivalent of Zoom, which has become a staple for most of our lives these last 3 months. And yet, while the specifics vary, many aspects of their life were like our own. They lived in a time of vast inequality. While the wealthy few grew in their fortunes, many lived in debt in order to pay for their basic expenses. They lived in a time of widespread disease with unknown cures or long-term solutions. By the time of the bubonic plague in the mid-14th century, those who were wealthy enough to flee cities did, in order to protect themselves from the plague, which was spreading among densely populated cities and killing many of the urban poor. While modern medicine and hygiene have vastly limited these kinds of events, we can all relate on some level to the fear of others and the fear of being amid our dense city when illness threatens our lives and livelihood, especially for those who do not have the means to stay in place. While modern medicine and hygiene have vastly limited these kinds of events, we can all relate on some level to the fear of one another and being amid our dense city when illness threatens our lives and livelihood, especially for those who cannot afford to remain in place or go to a place that feels more safe. Christians in the Middle Ages lived in an era of political instability, one in which the empire that once brought widespread peace was no longer as robust and powerful, damaged first by internal divisions and further by a changing global political reality. Our own situation, while substantially different, is not without internal political strife, nor changes to the international political dynamic. Our world is not the world of the medievals. Yet I hope as we learn alongside them, we see more of our commonalities than that which separates us from them. Now, before we get too far, I want to address naming and dating. Thus far, I've largely referred to this period as the Middle Ages. While sometimes referred to as the Dark Ages or the medieval era, the term Middle Ages derives largely from Petrarch in the 15th century, who coined the term Middle Age to refer to the generations before him. Petrarch was proud of his generation and the progress they had made. Petrarch and many of his Renaissance peers thought the Middle Ages had essentially pressed pause on Roman excellence and proper civilization that they had only recently rekindled. Petrarch and his contemporaries overlooked the contributions of the Middle Ages that allowed their world to be possible, such as the university, the printing press, sewage systems, among others. We have maintained the name in much of the sentiment of Petrarch. But over the next several weeks, I encourage you to challenge his position and be aware of what we miss if we simply skip past the lessons and contributions of the Middle Ages. When we talk about the Middle Ages, we're loosely talking about the late 5th century through the early 15th century. But most eras transition gradually. Nothing changed instantly in the late 400s to clearly demarcate this new era. Instead, it may be more accurate to talk about the waning of the classical era and the emergence of new medieval realities. Today we'll talk about Augustine's City of God, written in 426, which is properly a classical text. Yet it foreshadows the world that will be readily in place by the 8th century. The 5th through 8th century serve as a transitional period of the Middle Ages. While we will spend time this week and next looking at these centuries, most of our classes will look at the latter half of the Middle Ages, where the seeds planted in these earlier centuries have become deeply entrenched in medieval society. If we accept this broad range of dates for the Middle Ages, we're confronted with the sheer distance from one end to the other. It spans from Pope Gregory the Great in the late 5th century until Erasmus in the late 15th century. The world is vastly different from these vantage points, despite being lumped together into the Middle Ages. While this periodization does pose problems, particularly when it comes to developing the context of the Middle Ages, there is one component that knits together these disparate ends of the era: the role of the church. Despite changing territories and political commitments, the church functioned as the one true authority that knit together Europe and North Africa in these centuries. Christianity in the Middle Ages was widespread and dominant both in cultural life and in the political. In many ways, the Christian church was a defining element of medieval society. It saturates many aspects of our historical understanding, from the changing political landscape to the social practices of its people, to the academic discourse in its academies. The church is the tie that binds together these different people across the millennium in a shared faith and ritual, and is a leading contributor to their shared language. It's because of this that the Middle Ages are sometimes referred to as the Age of Faith. To understand the Middle Ages well, we need to spend a little time understanding the role of the Roman Empire in the classical era and its shape as we enter the Middle Ages. At the height of the Roman Empire in the 2nd century, it contained 70 to 90 million people, which is about 1/4 of the population of the United States today. It covered a vast territory from Spain to Eastern Europe, from Northern Britain down through the Sahara Desert. This vast empire created the Pax Romana, an era of relative peace, which freed its citizens to focus on intellectual pursuits. Christianity will find its origin within the bounds of this empire. In the 1st and 2nd century, Christianity was a fringe movement, a persecuted church. By 312, the year of Constantine's famous conversion, Christians composed about 1/10 the population of the empire, largely concentrated in the eastern portions of Rome's vast territory. With Constantine, the persecuted church becomes a tolerated church, and it's under these conditions the church prospered and spread like never before. By the 380s, if not sooner, Christianity would be the majority religion across the empire. In the 390s, under Emperor Theodosius, Christianity in effect became the official religion of the Roman state, as pagan temples were destroyed and pagan rituals were outlawed. The church of the late 4th and early 5th century is marked by cathedral building and the solidification of Christianity within the culture. We also see an increase in hermetic monks living in the deserts in Egypt, dedicating their lives to religious devotion. By this time, even at the far end of the empire in Britain, we have a clearly established Christian majority. The significance of this cannot be underestimated. The church spread widely and quickly throughout the empire, so that by the start of the Middle Ages, we can properly say that Christianity was the core foundation for life in the Middle Ages across Europe and North Africa. This anchoring will outlast the empire itself. As the Roman Empire wanes, the church does not go with it. In fact, it's fair to say that the church shifts into central focus in this era as that which binds together diverse people and nation-states, and in time, will wield the kind of political influence the empire once had. With that societal role also comes consequences, as we'll discuss next week when we look at the papacy in the Middle Ages. So Christianity is widespread across the empire by the end of the 4th century, when we begin to see the first signs of the downfall of Rome. The Roman Empire changed their organizational structure to accommodate two emperors, one for the west in Rome and one for the east in Constantinople. In 376, the empire was still intact even with this administrative setup. However, by the early 6th century, what existed of the empire looks quite different. From 476 onwards, there will be no emperor in the west at all. The Eastern Empire has only nominal authority west of the Adriatic Sea. The west is largely ruled by Germanic kings. After the initial division of the empire into these two administrative wings, but before the relative collapse of the empire, comes a series of foreign invasions. Barbarians invade Rome regularly in 410, 452, 455, and lastly in 476. The Roman emperor is deposed in this last barbarian invasion, which precipitates the dismantling of the Roman Senate. These invasions build off one another to weaken Rome's power and transform the robust optimism of the classical era into the more tentative stance of the Middle Ages. In many ways, we could say that the empire collapses in 476 with the fall of the West, but that would be an oversimplification of the historical situation in which the East remains in some form until 1453, in the final century of the Middle Ages. But to see the fall of Rome as largely the consequence of foreign invasions misses the reality of the empire in the 5th century. It struggled with its own economic woes, importing more than it exported. It failed to establish a reliable succession plan for emperors, which led to assassinations and military coups to overthrow existing emperors. Rome, as it was known in the classical era, slowly ceased to be the robust, optimistic, and inspiring political and cultural entity of its earlier centuries. It's into this failing version of the Roman Empire that we find Augustine. Those of you who joined us for our class on the Church Fathers know that we ended that class with a discussion of Augustine. We could dedicate an entire series of classes to him and his influence, as he wrote prolifically, and his writings have had an enormous influence not only on the Church of the Middle Ages, but the Church today. However, in this class, we will only briefly talk about him, as he is arguably a classical thinker rather than a medieval one. However, we start with Augustine because his writings will be the source of inspiration for many medieval authors, and he lives during the demise of Rome, which sets the scene for our later thinkers. Augustine was born in 354, and after his conversion in the late 4th century, moves into ministry. In 391, he becomes a priest, and in 395, he becomes a bishop. Augustine's influence in the Church of the Middle Ages is vast. As an abbot, Augustine establishes a community of priests who live in a pseudo-monastic order. He establishes guidelines for their shared life together, as a precursor to the monastic movement that we will see forming with Benedict and others later in the Middle Ages. Augustine has a robust doctrine of Scripture. In his reply to Faustus the Manichaean, he states, "With Scripture you have a few choices. Either the translation is wrong, the manuscript has an error, or you are mistaken in your understanding. But it is not wrong." In other words, it is entirely possible that you misunderstand Scripture or are working from false assumptions about the text, but it is not possible for Scripture to be untrue. Augustine affirms the divine inspiration of Scripture, and this affirmation will be the dominant view of the Church through the Middle Ages and the Reformation. Much of Augustine's theological writing was in direct response to the heresies he's encountered. Augustine was not a systematic theologian, but instead aimed to correct the errors he encountered in his time in ministry. He He also preached regularly. We believe he preached at least weekly, and he was a powerful rhetorician. It cannot be understated. Augustine was not a theologian in the sense that we often think of them, academics that advise ministers but who are not involved in the everyday ministry of the church. Instead, it's best to think of Augustine as a pastor who deeply cared for his community and devoted his life work to preaching the gospel and guiding his parishioners towards clarity in their understanding of who God was and how he interacted with them. As we mentioned earlier, the barbarians will invade Rome in 410. Rome is reduced to rubble, although it will not collapse entirely. This, for Augustine and his contemporaries, would have been the contextual equivalent of the attacks on 9/11 in New York and the Pentagon. Their great and mighty city was capable of falling. And if it could fall, what did that mean for the empire at large and for their individual lives? This will raise theological questions for the church. Did Rome fall because of our moral failures? Is this the revenge of pagan gods who are angry at our conversion to Christianity? These questions provide the grounds for Augustine's writing of the City of God, excerpts of which I have compiled for you. The City of God is ultimately a Christian theology of history. Augustine provides a way for the church to think about history's ebbs and flows, not primarily as the story of God or God's granting favor or punishment upon the world, but as the story of a fallen world in which God's people dwell. Part of the argument of the City of God is that God uses nations, but none are inherently Christian. Nations are required out of our fallen condition. It is because of sin that we need human rulers. In a perfect world, we would need no laws to constrain evil. So one should understand Rome's role in history and Christianity in light of this. God used Rome and rewarded her for her sense of justice. But Rome is not required for God's will to be enacted in the world. He used Rome, but he did not need her. The Christian, then, should view history as the story of two worlds, the City of God and the City of Man. The City of God is where people live by the Spirit instead of by the flesh. Its citizens use the things of the world, but find their full joy in God. Their city is an eternal city without end, which cannot be destroyed. The City of Man, however, is characterized by the love of self. Those who dwell here live by the flesh and according to their own desires, seeking things of the world to enjoy. This world is temporal. It will end and it will be destroyed. These two realities exist together, and yet they are distinct. Christians, as citizens of the City of God, will struggle to exist in these two worlds. Christians dwell in the City of Man as pilgrims and sojourners. This world is not their home. Instead, they are resident aliens in the city, temporary residents, but ultimately passing through to their true home in heaven. You've likely heard this language before as a way of identifying Christians in relationship to the world. Culturally, we've picked up on this language to talk about dwelling with God versus the struggles of our present era. Augustine wants his parishioners, in the face of civil distress, to recognize that their fate is not bound to their temporal reality. One does not need to see natural disasters, political chaos, or everyday hardships as signs to discern God's sentiments towards us. Rather, one must recognize that the world that we live in is not the way it's supposed to be, and the Christian is called to draw near to God. Now, for Augustine, this was never intended as a rejection of civil responsibility. When he talks about being resident aliens of the City of Man, he isn't saying this is a negative thing which one should long to be removed from. Instead, God has placed us into this world with purpose. One's goal isn't to simply survive until they can go to heaven, but instead, it is to improve the world that they dwell within. This understanding of history in the church will be the defining paradigm of the Middle Ages and set a background for the theological movements and conversations of the centuries that follow. Augustine will die shortly after publishing The City of God in 426. In 430, as barbarian armies are sweeping across his diocese, he becomes ill and dies. Augustine knew personally the hardships his parishioners faced as Rome declined and their stability, livelihoods, and very lives were in danger. In our discussion on Wednesday, we'll spend some time looking at the City of God in more detail and engaging with this text's role in the history of Christianity, both in the Middle Ages and today. As I mentioned earlier, much of Augustine's writings directly counteract heresies of his day. I want to end class today talking about one prominent heresy that began in the late 3rd century and is largely contained in the 7th century, despite reappearing later in history. The heresy is Arianism. We discussed this in our class on the Church Fathers as well, but I want to spend a few moments talking about the key ideas of this movement and why it is significant for our understanding of the early Middle Ages. Arianism rose up in the church in the late 3rd century, largely as a competing idea about the Trinity, taking particular aim at the divinity of the Son of God. In its most basic form, Arianism taught that the Son was a created being. It taught that there was a time when the Son was not. This was in response to the doctrine of the Trinity and the way the early church sought to understand how monotheism could be compatible with the three persons of the Trinity. Arius and his followers rejected the Trinity and believed that it was not compatible with monotheism. Instead, Jesus, the Son of God, was the first created being whom God the Father had made. In 325 at the Council of Nicaea, the Orthodox position on the Trinity was defined. It affirmed that the Son of God is begotten and not made, is divine, and is of the same substance as the Father. However, despite the official Catholic position, Arianism continued to exist and spread throughout the Roman world. The arrival of the Germans into the Western Roman Empire poses a serious threat to this Catholic Church. At the time of their arrival, none of them are Catholic. They are either Arian or pagan. Now I want to pause for a second and define Catholic here. We're accustomed to thinking about the Roman Catholic Church when we hear Catholic. And when I use the word Catholic, I both mean it in the way you think, and I do not. You may associate this with the Pope, priest, elaborate cathedrals, and the practice of confessing to a priest within the Roman Catholic Church. When we talk about the Catholic Church here, we are talking about that Roman Catholic Church. And in the Middle Ages, we'll see these people and practices in place. In fact, we'll see the rise of the supremacy of Rome to make it the Roman Catholic Church. But I am also talking about the Catholic Church in a very different way. We're accustomed to thinking of Catholic Christianity and Protestant Christianity as two distinct kinds of churches. We belong to the Protestant wing, and up the street at St. Hedwig's or down at St. Mary of the Angels are the Catholics. But in the Middle Ages, the Roman Catholic Church is our church. It stands in opposition to Arianism and not the Reformation. It can be tempting to make assumptions about the church based on our own experiences in and with Catholicism in modern America. But to listen well to the Church of the Middle Ages means being mindful of those presuppositions and to thoughtfully engage with the Church of the Middle Ages on its own terms. So back to the Germanic people. As they take over much of the western part of the Roman Empire, they pose an existential threat to the Catholic Christians. Despite Christianity's solid place in the Roman Empire, these new residents come with different beliefs. They are either pagan or have been converted to Arian Christianity. So by the 5th century, there are two societies which exist in the empire, the German Arians and the Roman Catholics. It's safe to say that there's hostility between these two groups. The future of Orthodox Christian beliefs hangs in the balance between these two people groups and theological systems. And then came Clovis, and almost more importantly, his wife Clotilde. Clovis was a king of the Franks who ruled over a portion of what is today France. He was born a pagan and converted to Arianism. Clotilde, however, was Catholic, and upon her regular insistence and devotion, helped Clovis to convert to Catholicism despite his earlier protest. Contemporary sources talk of Clovis' sincere conversion and devotion to his faith. Clovis also conquered most of Gaul or modern-day France. His Catholicism was unique among Germanic leaders, as many were Arian. With his political gain also came gain for the church as Nicene Christianity spread throughout his kingdom. I tell the story of Clovis, Clotilde, and Catholic or Nicene Christianity to point out the ways in which seemingly inconsequential political powers influenced the shape of Christianity in the Middle Ages. The story that Augustine was telling us of the city of God applies here. God did not need Rome or Clovis or any other nation. His gospel is not bound to these nations. And yet, the story of the church across history is of God working through nations and more specifically individuals, to further his kingdom. It is not a random incident that Clotilde continued to share the gospel with her husband. God used her to continue the good news of the gospel. It is not random that God used the Pax Romana to spread Christianity quickly throughout the European continent. The story of the Church of the Middle Ages is the story of God's work in the world. It's the story of Christians pursuing God, stumbling along the way, and yet God continues to work in them and through them. I hope as we continue to engage with this story that we will see the way that God has worked in history and the way that he's working in our world today. I hope you'll join us this Wednesday, June 17th at 7:30 p.m. as we discuss the historical context and specifically Augustine's City of God, as well as listen in next week as we look at Pope Gregory the Great and the development of the papacy in the Middle Ages.